Alone in the spacious and comfortable room where Narcissa had made me a bed, I offered up a prayer to the Lord of all creation, thanking him for the joy of having been useful. Then the blessed fatigue of those who have fulfilled their duties left me no time for further musings. Within a few minutes I felt a sensation of lightness throughout my body. I had the impression of being carried away in a small boat, sailing towards unknown regions. Where was I being taken? It was impossible to tell. A silent man sat beside me at the helm. I felt like a child, unable to describe the wonders before me. Ecstatic at the magnificence of the scenery, I let myself be carried along without a word. The little craft seemed to be sailing rapidly, and at the same time gradually ascending. After a short time I found myself in a marvelous harbor, and heard a voice calling me lovingly from the pier. "André, André." I could tell that voice from a thousand others. Overwhelmed with joy, I disembarked with childlike zeal, and a moment later I was in my mother's arms. She led me to a beautiful forest, where flowers seemed to retain light, offering a permanent feast of perfume and color. Luminous golden carpets stretched out under the rustling foliage of the great trees. I felt an ineffable sensation of peace and happiness, different from the dream states I had experienced on Earth. I was well aware that I had left my heavier body in my room in the chambers of rectification, and was conscious of being in higher sphere. My notions of time and space were accurate, and I felt the wealth of emotions I was experiencing grow more and more intense. After inspiring me with words of appreciation, my mother explained. "I prayed fervently to Jesus that I might be granted the sublime satisfaction of your visit on your first day of useful service. As you already know, my son, work is a divine tonic for the heart. Many of our companions, on leaving the earth, linger unproductively, awaiting miracles that never occur, their fine possibilities reduced to expressions of parasitism. Some plead discouragement from loneliness, others declare themselves maladjusted to the way in which they were called to serve the Lord. It is indispensable, André, to convert every opportunity in life into a reason to remember and serve God. Just as in the lower spheres the bowl of soup given to the hungry, the balm offered to the leper, and the gesture of sympathy towards one stricken by adversity, are sublime deeds forever remembered in the house of the Father. Here a look of understanding cast to the sinner, the promise of the gospel brought to those in despair, and hope imparted to the afflicted are blessings of spiritual work which also weigh greatly in our favor." I had never before seen my mother's face so beautiful. Her eyes seemed to shine with a spiritual radiance and her tender hands transmitted invigorating fluids and an indescribable sensation of bliss to me. "Jesus' gospel, André," she continued, "teaches us that there is greater joy in giving than in receiving. For our own happiness, let's learn to put this principle into practice in our daily efforts. Always give, my child, but above all never forget to give of yourself, in constructive tolerance, brotherly love and divine understanding. External charity is only a lesson, and a means to lead us to the more difficult practice of charity from within. Jesus gave more of himself to redeem mankind than all the earth's millionaires congregated in the fulfillment of material charity, however sublime their efforts may have been. Don't be ashamed to offer aid to our sickly brothers or clear the minds of the disturbed entities that come to the chambers of rectification, where I spiritually followed your work last night. Work, my child, doing all the good you can. In all our spirit colonies, as on earth, live restless souls anxious for novelty and distraction. As often as possible, try to avoid those amusements and devote yourself to useful service. Just as I, insignificant as I am, can see in spirit your efforts in the astral city, while following your father's suffering in the lower zone. God sees and accompanies us all, from the most evolved messenger to the lowest beings in the scale of creation." My mother paused briefly, and I tried in vain to speak. Although tears of emotion had rendered me speechless, she understood my feelings. Looking at me with deep affection, she went on. "In most spirit colonies, Services are remunerated with the hour bonus, which unites two essential factors. The bonus represents the possibility of receiving something from our brothers and co-workers, or of recompensing someone sharing our efforts. However, the determination of the hour's value, just as on earth, belongs exclusively to God. Because of our fallibility as evolving beings, errors may occur in awarding our bonuses. The real computation of the spirit hour is a private question between the worker and the divine forces of creation. That's why our experimental activities on the road to progress, starting at the physical sphere, undergo continuous, daily modifications. The administrator to whom the Lord has granted the opportunity of cooperating in the divine plan of life, experiment with tables, registers, and remuneration. He grants them this opportunity just as he grants his creatures the temporary privilege of being fathers or mothers on earth or in other worlds, and all sincere administrators do their utmost to carry out the tasks assigned them to the best of their abilities. Every father, conscious of his responsibilities, is full of devoted love. God also, my child, is a careful administrator and most loving father. He never forgets any of his children and reserves his right to a direct understanding with his workers about real merit of the use of their time. All outward reward affects the personality undergoing the test, but the value of time concerns the eternal personality, the one that will always be present in our circles of life, on its upward march towards the glory of God. This is why the Most High gives wisdom to those who spend time learning and a long life and greater joy to those who know how to forget themselves in serving others. Mother became silent. As I dried my eyes, she put her arms around me. Like a boy who falls asleep after a lesson, I lost consciousness of everything until I awoke in my room near the chambers of rectification with an invigorating sense of joy. Chapter 37, Veneranda's Lecture. All through my work the following day, I looked forward to Veneranda's lecture, which was scheduled to take place after the evening prayers. Knowing that I needed permission to attend, I sought out Tobias. "These talks," he said, "are only attended by truly earnest spirits. The instructors here can't afford to waste time. You may go along with the hundreds of workers and patients of the ministries of regeneration and assistance. I trust you will profit by it," he added, encouragingly. My new day was spent in intense activity. The visit to my mother and her enlightening words on the practice of good had filled my spirit with sublime contentment. At first her explanation of the hour bonus had raised certain doubts in my mind. How could compensation be granted by God? Wasn't the reckoning of time a task of the spirit or human administrator? Tobias explained that the task of recording the period of service was generally assigned to administrators, as was that of fixing standards of wages and privileges according to a worker's merit, but only the divine forces could accurately calculate the essential value of time. There are workers who, after devoting 40 years to some activity, end up just as inefficient as they began, a sure sign that they accomplished their task without the least spiritual interest. Likewise, there are people who after 100 years of earthly life will depart just as ignorant as they arrived. "To understand how precious your mother's concept is," Tobias said, "it is enough to compare the hours spent by good men to those wasted by bad ones. The former become fountains of divine blessings, while the latter are instruments of torture and remorse. Each living being must settle accounts with the Father for opportunities received and work accomplished." At the hour appointed for the lecture, following the evening prayer, Narcissa, Celestius and I made our way to a large natural hall. The hall was a wonder of shades of green, and we sat on comfortable benches formed from the vegetation. Various flowers glittered under the light of the chandeliers and scented the air with ineffable perfume. I looked around curiously. I noticed 20 of them sitting decidedly apart from the crowd, between us and the flowery mound which supported the lecturer's chair. I inquired, and Narcissa explained. "We are seated with the regular audience. The brothers in the special seats are the most advanced students on the subject to be covered this evening. They are the only ones allowed to ask the instructor questions or present arguments. They have acquired this privilege through their applying themselves to that particular line of study. We may also attain such a privilege, in time. Aren't you allowed to sit with them? I asked. Not this evening. As yet, I may sit there only when the lecture deals with the treatment of disturbed entities. However, some may stay for lectures on more than one topic, according to the degree of the knowledge they have already acquired. A curious procedure, I remarked. The governor, she continued, established the procedure in all classes and lectures in the different ministries to keep them from being converted into futile discussions of unfounded personal beliefs. Any worthy doubts or differing viewpoints may be duly considered and elucidated, but only at the proper moment. She had hardly finished speaking when Venerando entered the hall, accompanied by two women of distinguished bearing, who, Narciso informed me, were ministers of communication. Every face lit up with joy at the sight of Veneranda, who looked nothing like the old lady her name seemed to imply. She appeared to me to be noble, simple, and unaffected. After a brief exchange of words with the brothers in the special seating, she began by saying, "As usual, our short meeting does not allow for long bursts of eloquence. I am here to talk to you about certain thought processes. Among us tonight are a few hundred listeners who are still surprised about the similarity of forms on the physical plane and in our spirit sphere. They have learned that thought is the universal language, and have been told that mental creation is the most important factor in spirit life. Numerous brothers are asking themselves questions, such as why they find earthly dwellings, utensils, and even the same forms of speech here. Yet this fact should not be a motive of surprise to anyone. We must not forget that, up to now, while in the physical body, we have lived in circles of antagonistic vibrations. Thought is the basis of all spiritual relations, but we must keep in mind that we are millions of souls in the universe still far from perfect obedience to universal laws. We cannot, as yet, be compared with our older and wiser brothers nearer to the divine spheres. We are millions of entities living in the undisciplined inferior worlds of our ego. The great instructors of physical mankind teach divine principles and expound eternal truths, but in our earthly life we generally learn these laws without obeying them, we acknowledge these truths without consecrating our lives to them. Now then, do you imagine that by just admitting the power of thought, man can be purged of his inferior condition? Certainly not. It would be impossible. 100 years on the planet represent much too short a period of training for us to become divine cooperators. During our earthly apprenticeship, we learn the principles of mental force, but forget that, for thousands of years, we have used our thought energies to form destructive mental creations, or at best creations harmful to ourselves. We follow courses of spiritualization in the various religious schools of the world, yet, with most of us, it is frequently a question of mere verbal adherence, of lip service and nothing else. No one, however, can attend to his duty through words alone. The Bible teaches us that the Lord of life himself did not stop with the word, but put his creative work into action. We all know that there is an essential force, but we overlook the fact that we have misused that force over centuries. We all know that it is man's duty to provide for his own children, likewise each spirit is compelled to maintain and nourish his own creations. A criminal idea will produce mental creations of the same nature, a lofty principle will observe the same laws. Let me illustrate the fact with a more objective example. After rising to great heights, water is purified and carries vigorous vital fluids, returning as the vivifying dew and generous rains. Keep it on earth, mixed with the impurities on the soil, and it will become a foul mire, a habitat for destructive microorganisms. Thought is a living force everywhere. It is the creative atmosphere involving the father and his children, the cause and effects in the universal home. Through it men become either angels on their way to heaven or devilish fiends on the road to hell. Have you grasped the importance of this? Of course, evolved minds, both discarnate and incarnate, may communicate mentally without any need for form. Thought is, in itself, the basis of all of the mind's silent messages within the marvelous planes of intuition shared by beings of all kinds. Within this principle, a spirit who has lived only in France can communicate, mind to mind, with one in Brazil, regardless of language barriers. The language will always be that of the receiver. This, of course, depends on perfect attunement. However, we are not yet in the spheres of mental purity where all creatures are perfectly attuned to one another. Here we attune to one another in isolated groups and are compelled to carry on the transitory tasks of the planet so that we may return to it with a higher degree of efficiency. Therefore, the astral city as a transitory spirit colony is a great blessing granted us as an additional mercy in order that a few may prepare themselves to rise to higher spheres, and the majority may return to Earth on redeeming missions. I beg you, my friends, let us all realize the importance of the processes of the mind and live up to them from now on. Who is willing to try? She said as she smiled to the audience after a long pause. Soft music filled the air with melodious strains. The instructor continued to speak, radiating love, comprehension, sympathy and wisdom. Then, without any preparatory phrases or gestures, she closed her talk with a question. What? Is the lecture over already? I asked, surprised to see the audience rising to leave. That's Veneranda's way. The nurse answered with a smile. She always finishes her talks when the listeners are the most enthusiastic. She likes to say that the lessons of the gospel began with Jesus, but no one knows when and how they will end. Chapter 38, Tobias Home. On my third day in the chambers of rectification, Tobias delighted me with a pleasant surprise. After work, when the night attendants had taken over, I was taken to his home, where moments of instructive entertainment awaited me. When we arrived, he introduced me to two women, one already elderly and the other approaching middle age. He explained that the first was his sister, the second his wife. Lucien and Hilda, both gracious and affable, welcomed me cordially. We gathered in library, where I noticed beautifully bound books, all works of great spiritual value. Hilda invited me into the garden to see some delicately shaded arbors. Each residence in the astral city seemed to specialize in raising certain flowers. Lizia's home contained gloxinias and hundreds of lilies, while numerous hydrangea banks rose luxuriantly from a carpet of violets at Tobias' home. Here and there rose clusters of slender trees, reminding me of young bamboo, whose upper branches were joined by enormous flowery boughs of a curious climbing plant, forming a graceful canopy. An intoxicating fragrance floated in the air. I couldn't put my admiration fully into words. We were speaking of the beauty of the landscape in general, as seen from that angle of the Ministry of Regeneration, when Luciana called us back to the house for a light meal. Enchanted with the simple and cordial family atmosphere, I could find no words to give thanks to my host. After some friendly talk, Tobias said, smiling, "My friend André here is a newcomer to Out Ministry, and probably doesn't know my family background yet." They all smiled at me, and, noticing my silent interest, the head of the household continued. "In fact, there are several families similar to Out's here. You see, I was married twice," he added, pointing to both ladies good-humoredly. "Yes, indeed," I stammered, extremely confused. "You mean that both Hilda and Luciana shared your experiences on Earth?" "Exactly," he answered calmly. Hilda turned to me and said apologetically, "You must excuse our Tobias, brother André. Whenever we entertain newcomers from Earth, he always starts talking about the past." "And why not?" Tobias asked, good-humoredly. "Shouldn't it be a motive of legitimate joy to conquer the monster of jealousy, acquiring at least a small degree of true brotherly love?" "The problem really does concern us all," I remarked. There are millions of people on earth who have twice made sacred marriage vows. How would we resolve such a delicate sentimental problem in the face of spiritual survival? We know that physical death merely transforms without destroying, and that spirit ties continue unbroken throughout infinity. How to proceed, then? Condemn the man or woman for marrying more than once? We would find millions of creatures in the same circumstances. I have often wondered at the passage in the Gospel in which the Master, referring to marriage in eternity, promises us the life of angels. We must remember, however, added the kind host, with all due respect to Outlord, that we aren't yet in the sphere of angels, but that of discarnate people. But how can we cope with such a problem here? I asked. Very simply. We know that between the irrational animal and rational man there are a series of gradational positions. Likewise, between ourselves and the angels there is a great distance to travel. Therefore, how could we aspire to the company of such angelic beings if we aren't even fraternal with each other? Of course, there are strong-hearted travelers who, in a supreme effort of the will, face and surpass each obstacle they meet. The majority, however, can't do without bridges or the charitable help of devoted guides. Because of this truth, cases of this nature are settled through genuine brotherhood, keeping in mind that true marriage, a union of souls, can never be broken. Luciana, who had kept silent, joined in. However, it's only fair to add that we owe our present condition of happiness and comprehension to Hilda's spirit of love and self-denial. But Tobias' wife protested with humble dignity. Oh, please. Don't bestow virtues on me which I don't possess. But, so that our guest might learn from my painful apprenticeship, I'll try to summarize our story. With an introductory gesture, she began her touching story. Tobias and I were married while still very young, in deference to the sacred spirit affinity we felt. I don't think it necessary to describe the happiness of two souls who, united by real love, are joined in the holy vows of matrimony. Death, however, seemed jealous of our great bliss, and ended my physical life when our second child was born. Our grief was indescribable. Tobias wept hopelessly while I felt incapable of controlling my own despair. Oh, the sad days I spent in the lower zone, stubbornly clutching to my husband and two children, deaf to all exhortations sent me by my spirit friends. I wanted to fight, like a mother hen defending her nest, yet I realized that Tobias had to reorganize the home and that the children were badly in need of maternal care. My sister-in-law, who was single, couldn't stand the children, and the cook only feigned dedication to them. The two young nurses were unreliable girls, incapable of assuming any serious responsibilities. Faced with that unbearable situation, Tobias could no longer put off an urgent decision, and 1 year after my death he married Luciana. If you only knew how I fought against it, I was like a wounded tiger. In my ignorance, I went as far as to struggle against the poor girl, trying to kill her. It was then that Jesus, in his great mercy, granted me the providential visit of my maternal grandmother, who had passed over so many years before. I was greatly surprised to see her arriving somewhat casually, as if for no special purpose. She sat down and drew me to her lap, just as she used to when I was a child. She asked, tearfully, "Well now, my grandchild, what is your role in life? Are you a lioness or a soul conscious of God? Don't you see that our sister Luciana acts as a mother to your children, keeps your house, tends to your garden, and puts up with your husband's moods? Do you think she isn't good enough to become his temporary companion in the struggles of life? Is this the way to show your gratitude for divine benevolence and reward those who serve you? Do you want to accept Luciana as a slave, but despise her as a sister? Hilda, have you forgotten the teachings of the crucified? My poor, misguided grandchild." Throwing my arms around my grandmother's neck, I cried my heart out. I abandoned my old home in her company and came to serve in this blessed spirit colony. Luciana became as one of my daughters, and I began to devote all my energies to serious studies and to the moral improvement of my inner self. Tobias raised another family, which also became mine by sacred spirit bonds. I tried to help everyone in my old home, without exception. In time, Tobias came to join me here, and finally, to our great joy, Luciano also arrived. This, my friend, is our story. But Hilda didn't tell you how much she had to go through to teach me with her example, added Luciana. Now no, objected Tobias' wife, stroking Luciana's hand. Luciana continued with a smile. Thanks to Jesus and to Hilda, I learned that there are different kinds of marriages, those of love, of fraternal motives, of tests, and of duty. The day Hilda granted me forgiveness with a fraternal kiss, I felt that my heart broke away from the monster of jealousy. Spiritual matrimony forges a bond of souls, while others, even though sacred, are merely covenants of duty needed for the readjustment of past errors or fulfillment of redeeming processes. And so we organized our new home based on true brotherhood, Tobias added. How are marriages made here? I asked, availing myself of a pause. Through vibratory combination, Tobias explained kindly, or to make it clearer, by perfect attunement. Unable to control my curiosity, and forgetting my manners, I went on. But what is Luciana's position, exactly? When a married Tobias, a widower, I should have known that our union would probably be fraternal. Yet it cost me much suffering to understand that. In fact, it is only logical to conclude that when a couple suffers from restlessness, incomprehension and sadness, their marriage is only a physical union, not a spiritual bond. I still had another question, but could find no words to express it without seeming unduly indiscreet. Hilda sensed my thoughts, however. Don't worry, Luciano is already spiritually betrothed. Her companion of many earthly existences returned to the physical sphere a few years ago, and she'll follow him next year. I think the happy meeting will be in Sao Paulo. We all smiled joyfully. At that moment, Tobias was called to the chambers of rectification to attend to a serious case. Thus our pleasant talk came to an abrupt end. Chapter 39, Consulting Laura. Tobias' case made a deep impression on me. The memory of his home organized according to new principles of brotherly union haunted my mind. After all, I also still considered myself the head of an earthly household and could well imagine how difficult it would be if I had found myself in a similar position. Would I have the courage to follow Tobias' example? I thought not. I could not see myself as capable of worrying my dear Zelia so much, nor would I accept such an imposition on her part. My observations of Tobias' household tortured my mind, and I could find no satisfactory answer to my questions. I felt so perplexed that the following day I decided to pay Elysias a visit in my leisure time, in order to consult Laura, whom I trusted as a mother. I was welcomed with great joy and had to wait for an opportunity to talk calmly with my friend's mother. When the young people left for their usual evening entertainment, I found myself alone with my generous friend. Although embarrassed, I told her what was troubling me. She listened attentively and responded with a knowing smile. You were right in coming to discuss this question with me. The solution of any soul-searching problem requires friendly cooperation. After a brief pause, she went on. Tobias' case is but one example of countless similar arrangements here and in other spiritually evolved communities. But it does shock our feelings, doesn't it? I remarked earnestly. From a merely human point of view, those things are even scandalous. However, my dear friend, we must now consider, above all, principles of a spiritual nature. So, Andre, we have to try to understand the evolutionary phases of life. Since we have to undergo a long period of animal existence, we cannot expect to get rid of it all of a sudden. We take centuries to emerge from the lower stratum. Sex is one of the most misunderstood of divine faculties. Thus, for the present, it won't be easy for you to grasp the evolved aspect of the domestic organization you visited yesterday. Still, you may be sure that great happiness reigns there, through the atmosphere of comprehension between the performers of the earthly drama. It isn't everyone who succeeds in substituting bonds of light for chains of darkness in such a short time. But is that a general rule?